The day goes quickly, really. So we've got about maybe half an hour, but we'll see. You know, sometimes people don't have much to say, or at first they don't have much to say, and then it kind of proliferates. But we'll have a little bit of time at the end just for some metta, because we haven't really done formal metta practice in this day. But it's something that's really nice to integrate into your daily practice, just a bit of actual, you know, sending metta to yourself and to all beings. So, are there any questions, comments, or complaints? And don't be shy. Yes?
I have a question. I was really loving your talk earlier about kindness and really wondering where someone's behaviour, what that really represents. And I'm finding myself sort of sometimes judging a family member of mine who flies a lot. 12 flights already this year, and myself and my husband and my children took part in an Extinction Rebellion protest earlier in the summer, and there's a real sense of being really accepting of how somebody else chooses to live their life, but when they're a blood relative and it goes against what you really believe in, what you value, how to continue to be open-hearted and kind.
Yeah.
Because I really thought, okay, so maybe that constant needing to get away and that constant kind of distraction maybe is a reflection of how they are themselves. But it's just still hard sometimes to sort of really respect
that part
and that's it. So I just wondered if you had any...
Okay. So I'll just summarise for everybody and for the recording that you're asking about a family member who flies a lot all over the place, and perhaps they're restless, but it sort of seems to go against your values, and because they're a blood relative, it's quite difficult, because you're concerned about the environment. Yeah. I think often things are more difficult with people we feel close to and that we identify with, and it's often because there's a sense of self involved there. Sense of self always causes suffering, more suffering, extra suffering, because there'll be a lot of people going around flying a lot and doing all kinds of things which aren't very sort of sensitive perhaps to the environment, or maybe haven't come to your understanding of what's needed to protect and conserve the environment. And so, you know, we have this sense of self, which is already very strong, but then it widens and becomes a circle of me and mine and my relative and my friend. And I don't know about you, but in my family, there are similarities. We do hold some values, you know, in common. But it's not always the case. And you know, just because you're a blood relative doesn't necessarily mean they do see things in a similar way. But I found with my family, because obviously I wanted them to get interested in Dhamma and sort of appreciate my values, and sometimes I find them quite materialistic compared to me, obviously. Because, you know, as a nun, you sort of give up all of that. But then I realised that it wasn't helpful for me to make judgments, because whenever I did that, it just closed them up more. It wasn't the way to sort of approach things. It felt like a criticism of them. And that made them more upset, more unhappy, and so less likely to come to that. And it could be the same with your family member, you know, that if they feel you're condemning it, that makes them even more tense. And if there is some suffering in them that causes them to do that in the first place, that might even increase. So I think it's better to lead by example and just to be very clear and consistent in your own ethical systems and decisions, and try to be kind to this person. Just try to be kind. I mean, maybe you could like leave out a magazine or sneaky ways. But there's very little we can really do to change others. I think it's just about being around like-minded people that can help you feel supported in what you choose to do, and then protecting your own mind from the negativity that might arise, because you need your energy and your positivity to continue to do the work you believe in. That's probably more important than changing one person. Yeah. Does that help? Yeah.
You talked about the sense of self. And sometimes I think I get that, and sometimes I don't get it.
Of course.
And often when you listen to people, they sort of, I think that you've got a sort of basic understanding of it. And I just wondered if you could kind of give a real dummy's guide to like a sense of self and what that is, you know.
Yeah.
The real kind of basics, and in an accessible kind of way.
In an accessible way. I mean, you're asking for a dummy's guide about the sense of self. Maybe I'm a dummy. I don't know. Actually, these things are quite deep, but my teacher always says if you can explain it in a simple way, you've understood it. So, I mean, for me, it's not entirely clear. And I think for most of us, we go between... There's a kind of spectrum, you know, of a very solidified sense of self when we're getting sort of caught up in our own identification with our body or our emotions, our mental states. It's that sense of identification that creates a really strong sense of self. Like, we become very, very concerned with it to the point that we don't really understand that it's conditioned. You know, we start to believe it as this solid entity that's always going to be that way. And then you have the other spectrum, which is where the sense of self starts to get very faint. And that often happens in meditation. And the reason that, for me, I find when it becomes much less solidified is when there's less doing, because the sense of self always carries this quality of having to do something to express itself, you know, having to do something in the world or having to control the meditation process. So for me, one way that I've learned to meditate, which helps me to undermine the sense of self, is just to back off and to allow the process to happen. So all of these causes we talked about, I focus much more on putting causes into place and focusing on, like, if this cause is in place, then this effect arises, rather than it's me doing the practice. So then I start to see, okay, kindness has the effect of, like, buoying the mind up, bringing happiness, bringing peace to the mind. So if I put that cause in place, then this is a natural consequence. And then I can start to just allow that to unfold rather than to be involved in it. Because as soon as the sense of self is that thing that thinks, this isn't good enough, I want to change it, I have to do something, it's up to me, and then you start to get involved and the whole thing usually goes wrong. So there's various ways to understand it. I mean, it's obviously identifying strongly with the body, the mind, the mental states, yeah. And seeing them as these fixed things that you have control over, compared to understanding that they're processes that arise dependent on conditions that we can't really control. We can influence them, we can have a good attitude towards things that arise, like I've been saying, but we can't actually control them and make them the way we want to. So it all goes hand in hand with realizing that these things are impermanent, they're subject to change. Yeah. Anicca and dukkha. Suffering. Yeah. Does that help? It was a bit all over the place. Yeah. So it's sort of, in summary, it's like you can understand the sense of self by what it does and how it identifies.
Like the texture of thoughts.
Like
it was explained once, I think, it's like the texture of thoughts. You know, they're sticky kind of thoughts.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's definitely when clinging comes in, it solidifies it further, yeah. Yeah. Any kind of clinging or identification. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the reason I mentioned it in the context of meditation is because I think it's a place you can actually see how it works and at a subtler level, because otherwise it becomes very conceptual. And the fact is, we can't understand it until we're like, we have the first stage of enlightenment. We can't really get it intellectually. So it's more just noticing what happens when there's a sense of self, how does that build suffering? And when there's less of a sense of self, how does that release suffering? That's another way to look. Any more questions? Yeah.
You spoke about jhana and deep concentration and stillness. Do we need that, or is it possible to progress without it? If you do need it, what do you do if you're busy?
So you're asking if jhana is necessary, stillness states. I don't use the word concentration, but stillness, deep stillness. And how to develop that in daily life, or whether it's possible to develop in daily life. The Buddha did talk about an Eightfold Path, and so if it wasn't necessary, it wouldn't be in the Eightfold Path. So I think it is necessary. I mean, that's very clear from the teachings. And if you open any of these books, you'll just see jhana, 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 jhana. And one of the things the Buddha says is that without these deep states, then the five hindrances invade the mind and remain. So we do have to overcome them at some point in order to have a chance to see things as they are. But I wouldn't worry too much about whether you're a lay person or a monastic, because this is a really long path and it's a process. And you can work at many levels, like I've tried to explain today. There are many, many ways to prepare the mind. And sometimes lay people come to retreats with my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, and they get into these things just because the conditions are there for it to happen. Perhaps they've been living particularly virtuous lives, or some of them are high flyers, actually, like quite busy executive-type people, and they come completely exhausted, rest a lot, develop the right attitude, and then there's a certain letting go that happens. I think also perhaps with Asian, I mean, they tend to be people from Singapore, Malaysia. They maybe have a little bit more devotion and trust in the teacher, so they actually do sort of back off and let go, and they tend to get into these things. So they're not to be seen as attainments that are really hard work. They're more to be seen as natural consequences of living a wholesome life, an ethical life, and cultivating all the causes. And they come when they're ready to come, and no one can predict it, you know. You can be a monastic for years and years and it doesn't happen, or you can be a layperson and fluke it. But in the end, it doesn't really matter. That's not the most important thing, because the most important thing is to have a really strong foundation. You know, just getting into a jhana once or twice won't really do it either. So the most important thing is, like, how are you living? What kind of qualities are you developing? And in time, it'll happen. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. But yeah, I think it's a little bit dangerous to sort of worry that, okay, well, if it's not possible in lay life, then maybe it's not really necessary, because that is diluting things. I'm not saying you're doing that, but there can be that tendency to want to make them something softer, less deep, easier to attain. And it's really not about attaining. It's about coming out of suffering. So as long as you know you're coming out of suffering bit by bit, even just within half an hour's meditation, then you're on the right path. So don't worry too much. Can't see most of you.
Yeah. As a lay person on this path, yeah. I'm interested to know how you go about finding a spiritual teacher. Because I find a lot of my family members and friends aren't on the same path.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure how to sort of get further into it and have somebody that I can sort of speak to regularly about staying on the path and questions.
So you're asking about finding a spiritual teacher in the lay life, because you recognise the importance of that for continuity and progress in the practice. Yeah, and I think it's true. I think we need Dhamma friends, certainly. If we can have a teacher, it's even better. I know for me it's been wonderful. But in my early years, I didn't have a personal teacher. It was more that I had a meditation practice that really worked for me. And so it was more like the technique or the method was my teacher, and it worked for me. And then there was a sort of wider Dhamma group associated with that where I could contribute, I could serve, and I could be part of a wider community. So that was really helpful, and I think that you can find, you know, maybe by coming here or by going to monasteries if you want to, you know, you can find communities of practitioners, and amongst them you may find people who you think may be your teacher. It's difficult to find teachers who sort of can give that much time and attention without them being involved in your circle, I would say. So from my perspective as a monastic, for example, I mean, a couple of people have come to me and said, can you be my teacher? And I sort of said, well, I mean, I don't really set myself up in that way. But it's more the case that if you associate with people over time, then you feel supported and you can sort of see how the practice works in everyday life. So, you know, going to monasteries, I would say, is a great way to do it. If you find a particular monk or nun that you like, go to monasteries, like live there, be part of the community. You know, you'll get that ongoing... You need relationship over a long period of time to get one-to-one guidance. I mean, it's difficult, even with my teacher. I suppose I was really persistent, but very few people have a personal relationship with him because he's just so busy and so, you know, all over the world all the time. So it's not easy. you can use YouTube. There are lots and lots of talks on YouTube, and that really helps people sometimes. And then being associated with other students of a particular teacher. And then also I'd say go for the suttas. I mean, I know that these probably look quite daunting to a lot of people, which is why I wanted to read some bits out, which I think are just beautifully phrased. And it can be daunting without a teacher, but also you can get a lot of talks that explain the suttas online. And it's wonderful when this starts to happen, because it's almost like you feel you've got a direct connection to the Buddha himself. And in the end, the Buddha is our teacher. I mean, all these teachings were descended from him. We wouldn't be here without that. And I think if you can sort of find people who can help you understand and have a foot into these, that's really wonderful too. And then you can be independent from any particular person. Yeah. So that's a range of things. But, I mean, just hanging out in these kind of places and in monasteries and, you know, trying to join meditation circles over time, you may be lucky and find a personal teacher. Yeah. But most people, I think most people, how many people here have a personal teacher just as a... Yeah. No one. So, yeah, it's more the teachings than a personal teacher, but it is important to associate with good people who are practicing. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm amazed, actually, that no one has a teacher. Yeah.
Can I just add something to that?
Yeah.
Because I've often described myself as like pick and mix Buddhism, and kind of get my teachers from all over the place, and I think there's a real value in different teachers as well, and not being too attached to one. That feels really useful to me.
So just to paraphrase that for the recording, that you were saying that there's a lot of value in having different teachers and being able to take tips and methods and guidance that works for you from a various range of teachers. Yeah, that's true. Yes, Paul.
What's the difference between mindfulness and consciousness, and how does mindfulness relate to clear comprehension?
Okay. Well, mindfulness and consciousness are different. I mean, obviously, mindfulness is a quality of consciousness, but consciousness is just knowing, like it's just the actual awareness that happens at any of the six senses. So it's not just the mind sense. It's also the sense of sight, the sense of smell, hearing, tasting, touch, and mind. So mind consciousness is one of those. But you can have mind consciousness which is cloudy, mind consciousness that's restless, mind consciousness that's all kinds of things. So mindfulness would be a quality of mind that is a little clearer. So a sort of clearer state of mental consciousness than the normal state. But sati sampajanya is a really good question, because again, this word mindfulness is everywhere nowadays, and it's become very overused, and everybody's talking about mindfulness of chocolate, eating chocolate, mindfulness of working in the defence ministry, and all kinds of mindfulness. But the Buddha's understanding of mindfulness is that it is for a specific purpose. So it has to be used in order to understand things as they are, in other words, to understand things with wisdom. Yeah, and part of that means, like I was saying, you know, it has to include right intention. So it's being able to shed light on where we suffer and why we suffer and how to come out of suffering. So if you're using mindfulness to, like, shoot a gun at somebody, that's not the mindfulness the Buddha's talking about, because it doesn't contain the wisdom element. So sampajanya is the wisdom element. It's mindfulness is being aware, and sampajanya is knowing the purpose of why you're aware, yeah? A bit like I said again with kindness, like mindfulness illuminates the content of experience in the present moment, and kindness and wisdom, sampajanya and right intention say, how can I soothe it, how can I calm it, how can I lead it to peace? So it's knowing what to do with the mindfulness. Does that make sense?
Yes, so would it be... being able to, like, say, for example, recognise the hindrances and what to do when they're present?
Yeah, it includes all of that, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's sati sampajanya that's discussed in this gradual training after the sense restraint, and in various places where the gradual training's mentioned, it comes either before or after, so the two kind of circle each other. So you have to understand, it's like... that maybe many of you know this, but Ajahn Brahm tells a really great story about mindfulness to sort of make a bit of fun of it. But it's the simile of the lady who told her gatekeeper or whoever he was, be aware, you know, I'm going out, be aware, don't let the burglars in. Be aware if the burglars come. And so all the burglars started coming to the house, and he said, oh, burglar coming, burglar coming, burglar coming. And then the burglar came in and took something. Oh, burglar going out, burglar going out, burglar going out. And then he came in again. Oh, safe going out, safe going out, safe going out. TV going out, everything going out. So, and then she got back and said, what on earth happened? You know, I asked you to be aware. And he said, but madam, I was aware. I saw the burglar, and I said, burglar coming in, burglar coming in. But the point is that it didn't have wisdom with it, and he didn't understand the purpose of being a gatekeeper. So mindfulness has a purpose. You have to understand its purpose. And one of the purposes is to protect the mind from unwholesome states and to guard the wholesome states. So mindfulness also acts like a gatekeeper, a wise one. Yeah, to let the friends in and keep the enemies out. Does that answer the question? Yeah. Any complaints? Anything unclear? Yes.
Just an extra question.
Yeah, sure.
You spoke about the balance or the tension between a boundless kindness.
Mm. Yeah, that was just a play on words. So you're asking about the sort of so-called paradox, in a way, between having developing kindness, which is boundless, which is talked about in the suttas, immeasurable, boundless, without hostility and without ill will, that spreads everywhere, and a kind of kindness which has boundaries, yeah? And whether there's, I don't know, some relationship there in the suttas. Not explicitly, but I think that wherever the Buddha talks about boundless compassion, boundless loving kindness, he says to all as to oneself. So it's boundless in the sense that it's to all, but that doesn't discount oneself. So it's not that you kind of light a fire to keep everybody warm but get burned yourself, set yourself on fire, you know, or run yourself dry. So the intention can be there to have boundless compassion, and you may be able to send compassion even to people who've hurt you very deeply. But boundaries would be whether or not you want to actually see that person and whether you want that person in your life. That's why I said you can love the tiger from a distance. You know, you can actually forgive a person, you can develop loving kindness to a person, but it doesn't mean that you have to compromise your own well-being and safety, and you shouldn't. So that kindness should go equally to yourself. And in my own experience, I mean, I did have quite an abusive situation with the same person who said that she hates herself because that's why she wants to transcend herself. And she ended up being abusive. And I really questioned myself, you know, what was it in me that could let that in a way, you know, because I felt like so confident that could never happen, something like that could never happen. And I realised I'd leaked far too much energy into that other person, and I had sort of forgotten to protect myself because there were signs of aggression and violence along the way. And then I went to a metta retreat in Italy, and I was not intentionally thinking about her at all, because even in the metta practice, I think until you're ready to send metta to somebody very difficult, it's not wise. You first need to build up that metta to yourself and to the loved one and to people you feel safe with. But because the metta was going really well, just the memory of that person came up, and I realised, like, intuitively that in my current state of feeling so resourced and nurtured through kindness, there's no way I could have been attacked. It really felt like there was a very strong protective shield around me. And I kind of realised my mistake, that I'd forgotten the compassion for myself. So it should, yeah, you have to respect yourself, respect your boundaries. And it's like compassion has to be wise, kindness has to be wise, not just silly compassion. Yeah, and also I realised in myself, I mean, this might relate to others, but there was maybe a need in me to be that saviour for a person, you know? And that isn't really kindness. That can come from a sense of oneself as the saviour, oneself as the giver, the kind person that won't let others down, the kind person that's always there, you know? And, yeah, this is not really true kindness to oneself. Yes?
The idea of being able to see things as they actually are.
Mm.
So how are they? What is it I can't see?
Well, this is what we don't really know. I mean, the Buddha is pointing us to notice that things are impermanent, and it doesn't only mean that they change. It actually means that they can go. Basically, everything arises from a cause, and if that cause is removed, the effect disappears completely. So at a very, very deep level, impermanence would be things just disappearing completely. Yes, I mean, in a state of, yeah, you as well. Yeah, because, well, it's not that... The thing is, it's not that we were here in the first place. It's something is here. I mean, this is directly from the suttas now. I'm just saying it in the Buddha's words. He says that it's not that there's nothing because arising is seen, but it's not that there's something because passing away is seen. And it's another angle on the middle way. He said, what it really is a process. What we are is a process. It's a process of causes and conditions. Cause and effect, rolling on without a permanent essence in there. So in that sense, there's no self, like as in the self is not a permanent essence. But it's not that there's nothing here. Otherwise, we couldn't talk to each other. We couldn't, you know, use names. And it would be impossible. I'd have to say, oh, hello, impermanence, how are you today? So it's seeing those things, actually seeing them disappear, not just understanding that they're impermanent, but actually seeing them disappear. And the same with suffering, not only understanding that there's suffering and that there's a cause, but actually seeing it go. And that's why they say Nibbana is the ultimate bliss, because suffering ends. So we have to see that ourselves. So, I mean, definitely that's where our mind is pointed to by the teachings. But, like I said, as long as there are hindrances there, we can't see deeply enough into it because it's just too scary as well. It's just too scary to see.
Hardness on this, yeah. Because we're all on the path. And when we get to some point, then this will just... We'll see this for what it is that it isn't.
Something like that. So you're asking if we see everything as solidified because we're not yet seeing things clearly, and later on we might see that, yeah, it's actually not as solid as we thought, you know. I think so, yeah. I mean, you'll probably notice in your own practice that at times when the mind is clearer, things feel much less fixed. You know, you can relate to other people in a less fixed way. You can relate to yourself in a less fixed way. You see your past differently sometimes. Like, if the mind's full of metta, for example, or full of happiness, everything looks different. The world looks different. Trees look beautiful. The leaves glisten. You look at past memories and you see them in a totally different way. Or you just have different memories coming up completely, you know. And there's this nice simile in the suttas called the simile of the salt crystal. And it says that if you put a salt crystal in like a glass of water, how does it taste? It tastes like incredibly salty. But if you put it in a huge lake, you can't even taste the salt. So it's kind of like that. Our minds see things differently from a much bigger perspective. And then we start to doubt our perception. Yeah. Start to notice it changes depending on your state of mind. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm. Two more, okay.
This isn't really a question, so that's all right. Illegal, but I just wanted
illegal.
To say
get the police.
That there was this amazing moment earlier today when you had said in the morning meditation about trying to add kindness to mindfulness, as a way of thinking about, we could use the sun as a way of thinking about that it has also warmth as well as light. And it just seemed really miraculous that after lunch, the sun was both incredibly clear, this beautiful winter sunshine, which is so rare, but also actually like made me take my coat off. And I felt somehow yeah, the miracle of being able to be here on this winter day when, you know, all of these causes and conditions came together.
Oh, that's lovely.
So it was really beautiful.
Yeah. Great. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, that's great. I think that's the thing when the mindfulness and kindness, the kindfulness increases, you can actually appreciate the elements and, you know, all the gifts that we have much more clearly.
Yeah.
The mind is just much more receptive. Yeah. Great. One question over here. Yeah.
Just thinking in with a few of the other questions and the theme of loving kindness.
Yeah.
And talking about seeing with the mind. But could you maybe say a little bit, more about seeing with the heart, which seems to be maybe more where the seeing should be happening.
Yes. I think for me, I use those terms kind of interchangeably. So it's not so much mind, it's more heart. I guess when you say heart, are you talking more about the emotive sort of qualities than the cognitive ones, I guess? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what I try to encourage at the beginning of the meditations when we sort of try and remember things like kindnesses that we've done or that others have done towards us or how it feels to be with people who are kind. Because it is a feeling, it's not a thought or a concept, you know. You can say the word kind, and it has a certain association, like it's quite a nice word. But one of the really nice things that you can practice in meditation is to kind of say a word to yourself, like kindness, and then listen. Just listen, like, okay, let's experiment. So close your eyes, and then we just say the word. And the mind already has some association, so when I say kindness, see if you can listen to the emotional resonance in your heart, whether it's in your heart area or anywhere in the body, but getting in touch with the feelings in the body. Kindness. 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 So it's just listening to where it's leading. It might be more effective to focus on like an aspect of kindness such as warmth, which has maybe more of an emotional feeling to it. Peace is also a nice one to do. My teacher sometimes does this when he says just peace, and I listen in, and you can just feel the peace in his voice and whole being, and it's really fantastic actually. Sometimes the mind doesn't need much to point it in a certain direction. And it's the same with metta. We can use phrases, you know, like may you be happy, may I be free from suffering, whatever we choose, but it's giving it a gap and listening to what that really means and allowing the heart time to look in that direction. It's like the words are pointing you in a certain direction, but it takes time for the emotions to sort of well up. Does that make some sense?
Yeah,
Good. Well, it's only 10 more minutes now, so I wonder, shall we, if there's... Are there any more, like, really important... Okay.
Is there anything that you would recommend for the layperson to learn about the suttas?
About the suttas? Yeah, there's a couple of books by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So he's the one that translated these big ones, but he's got a couple of anthologies which are really nice. There's one called In the Buddha's Words, which is about that thick, and there's one called Communal and Social Harmony, which is quite a smaller one, and that has stories like these three monks about the way they used to look at each other with kindly eyes and reflect on how fortunate they were to live together and that sort of thing. And that's quite a nice, easy access book. So it looks very much like, it looks the same as that, the same sort of maroon colour but smaller. And that's by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Yeah. So, Social and Communal Harmony by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It's really lovely. It just has all these different passages, and he gives an explanation before each chapter about it. So, That's nice. And also, I would like to plug my own teachers because they have some wonderful sutta discussions on YouTube. You can find them. So they'll take a sutta from any of these books and they'll just talk about it. But their knowledge goes beyond one sutta. It goes to the whole text. So they bring in things from all over the place and really contextualise the teachings. And that was the way I started to get really interested, and it started to open up the Buddha's words to me. So that's Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Pramali, both of them. You can find them on BSWA YouTube channel. Yeah. I'll be in the library afterwards. There'll be some leaflets and I'll be there, so you can say hello. Good, so... Oh, okay. One more? Yes, I think so. I think it will be on Dharma Seed. I'll have to check. And just before we do go into the metta, maybe at the end, anybody who is not comfortable with having their question on Dharma Seed, please let me know. Otherwise, the Q&A session will be on Dharma Seed as well, hopefully. But at least it will be on the Gaia House website. I'm not sure exactly what the relationship is there between Gaia House and Dharma Seed, but it will be on the Gaia House website. Is that right, Michelle?
What normally happens is the teachings go out to the group.
Ah, okay. Okay.
And then they go on Dharma Seed.
Okay. So the teachings go out to the group and then they go on Dharma Seed. Yeah? Good. Excellent. So we've only got a few minutes, but it might be nice just to share the merits of the day, which is Shala Well. So if you'd like to get comfortable again, I might give you a blessing if that's all right. Yeah? Give you a blessing as well. So, as usual, when we sit, just coming into contact with the body, with the heart. If you want to put your attention on the heart area, the middle of the chest, please do so and be very gentle. And to start the metta, I like to choose a loved person who's very easy to generate feelings of goodwill towards. So this may be someone in your life who you're very close to, perhaps a best friend, or it can't be a teacher because none of you have teachers. Or it could be one of your teachers. It could be a parent or a child, even an animal. Someone or some being who, when you think of, brings a smile to your heart and to your lips. Imagine that person or that being in front of you. And in your own words, wish them well. Choosing very simple words such as may you be happy, or may you be safe. And offering these words to your good friend. Imagining in that person receiving those words, those sentiments, and relaxing, smiling back at you. Noticing the feeling of metta, loving kindness, in your heart. Mm. repeating the words and listening to where they're leading. Trusting in the intention of your sentiment. And now allowing the metta, the loving kindness in your heart, to spread out of your body and into this room. To touch each person in here, wishing each person, may you be well, may you be happy, may you be safe. Imagining that loving kindness filling up the room like the warm sunshine, spreading a golden glow across everybody. Reaching our hearts, bringing a smile to each person's lips and to their heart. May we be well. May we be happy. May we be peaceful. Notice how that feels in your own body and mind. Now imagining the whole world and all the beings, visible or invisible, beings in the water, on the ground, under the ground, beings in the sky. Beings on the other side of the planet, down in Australia, across the oceans. All beings desiring their own happiness. Sometimes unaware of the harm they cause to others. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be liberated. Now come back gently into your own body, sensing your own heart area. Meeting yourself and realizing that you too deserve your own loving kindness. You may want to imagine yourself as though you were sitting in front of you, or maybe get a sense of the shape of your body sitting here on the cushion. Noticing that this being too needs kindness. Whatever you've done, give yourself the gift of forgiveness. May I be well. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. And choose your own words, imagining smiling at yourself, looking into your own eyes. And with absolute sincerity, wishing yourself well. Keeping connected with the feeling of metta in your own body and heart, I'm now going to chant the final blessing of metta. Sabbe sata, sabbe pana, sabbe Buddha, sabbe Pugala, sabbe Atabawa Pariyapana, sabbe Itiyo, sabbe Purisa, sabbe Ariya, sabbe anariya, sabbe deva, sabbe manusa, sabbe vinipadika, avirahantu, abhyapajahantu, anigahantu sukhiyatanam pariharantu dukkhamunjantu yatalata sampatito mave gacchantu kamadaka. Very good. So thank you very much for being here, for your practice, for taking a whole Sunday to come and practice. It's really wonderful. So I think now is usually the time for a little talk on generosity and the value of giving. And I'm not going to talk too much about that because one of the coordinators, I think, is hopefully hanging around. But I'll just say a little bit about my own project so that you know what any donations towards myself will be used for. So as a Buddhist monastic, I do live on the generosity of others completely, and that is usually in the form of food or other kinds of material support, known as the four requisites, so food, medicine, clothing, which is one robe, a bit of cotton and a few patches, and what's the other one? Food, medicine and shelter. So shelter is something we're trying to develop because obviously as monastics we don't live in houses, but we try to establish monasteries, and I've been charged with the rather big and sometimes daunting job of starting a monastery in England for women to train as fully ordained nuns, equivalent to that of the Theravada monks, which has not been possible so far in this country. So as you're looking at me now, I am the only one in the whole country who has actually taken the full ordination. So this is important for several reasons, not only equality and feeling empowered, feeling confident, also leading communities, you know, in ways that women maybe want to lead, which may be different from the patriarchal model. I mean, everybody brings something different to their own practice and way of living. But I think that women living together tend to be a little less hierarchical, and it's maybe more focused on the community, on sort of a flat model, which is actually very much in alignment with the early Buddhist teachings, which were flat. It was a flat model. There was no particular ranking. You know, obviously we pay respects to those with a lot of wisdom or seniority, but there were incidences of, you know, the Buddha's chief disciples being deferential to a seven-year-old who told this particular chief disciple that his robe was not on correctly. He said, "Thank you, my teacher," which was very beautiful. Which is slightly off the point, but anyway, at the moment that's what I'm doing, and so any donations that you give for the teacher, for the teachings, will be not coming to me personally. I can't handle money as a monastic. They'll be going into something bigger, something that supports myself, but that will also support all of you. So in the long run, depending on the support we get, we want to create something which has a facility for lay men and lay women to come and stay, and also for women to train as nuns, whether they take the first step on eight precepts, dressed in white, you may have seen these sort of novices in some of the monasteries here, or whether they want to go through to the full training as fully ordained monastics. Women need the chance, and they need a choice. You know, we do have monasteries in this country, and they offer an ordination platform for women, which is very similar to the full ordination, but it doesn't actually have the official recognition, and this is problematic when it comes, as I say, to developing their own communities, but also, more importantly, they're not able to give full ordination to other women because they're not themselves full members of the Sangha. So this really limits the spread of the Dhamma and the spread of Buddhism, because the Buddha always talked about the fourfold assembly. So that included male, female, lay people, lay disciples, and also monks and nuns fully ordained. And this, the Buddha said, would predict, would ensure the survival of Buddhism for generations to come. So sadly, Buddhism lost one of its limbs, one of these four legs of the chair, so to speak, with the so-called disappearance of bhikkhunis about 1,000 years ago. But it was preserved in the Chinese Mahayana tradition, and we've been able to take the ordination from there and start it again. So any donations you want to share today will be going for this, and will hopefully contribute to teachings being offered, you know, not only by myself, but by other monastics and maybe other lay women, other lay men who have the chance to get established in Dhamma. So, you know, it's important that we don't only keep meditation limited to retreat time and being on the cushion, but that we have communities and we have places that people can go and practice. You you know, and live all these different aspects of the path that I was discussing today. Yeah. So that's it for me, because there are other places that you can also contribute your generosity, which include Gaia House. So do you want to come up and say something about that? And then I'll go to the library now. I think you have about another 20 minutes or so before the retreat ends, and there'll be some information in the library. So if anyone wants to meet me there, I'll be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.